We continue with Special Counsel Jack Smith's brief for the United States in Donald Trump v. United States, picking up at the top of page 18. C. Criminal immunity for a former president enjoys no support from Nixon v. Fitzgerald's recognition of civil immunity. Petitioner argues that Fitzgerald supports his claim of absolute immunity from criminal prosecution. That is incorrect. In Fitzgerald, this court held that a former president is immune from a civil damages suit based on official acts within the outer perimeter of presidential responsibility. The court explained that a private citizen's interest in recovering damages was outweighed by the burden on the presidency posed by the threat of scores of civil suits brought by people affected by presidential decisions. The court thus held that immunity from civil liability under otherwise valid laws is a functionally mandated incident of the president's unique office, rooted in the constitutional tradition of separation of powers. In other words, the court deemed such immunity to be required by Article 2 because private damages suits would prevent the president from accomplishing his assigned functions. Applying Fitzgerald's reasoning in this context, however, leads to the opposite result. Article 2 does not grant a former president absolute criminal immunity because the calculus on each side of the scales fundamentally differs. The interest in enforcement of federal criminal laws is far weightier than the private damages claim at issue in Fitzgerald. And the many safeguards against unfounded federal prosecutions refute petitioner's argument that the Constitution requires an absolute bar against federal prosecution of a former president. 1. The interest in applying federal criminal law to all persons is compelling. The charges in this case alleging a president's crimes to overturn an election and perpetuate himself in power illustrate the compelling public interest in enforcing the criminal law. The commitment to the rule of law is nowhere more profoundly manifest than in criminal justice. Indeed, the primary constitutional duty of the judicial branch is to do justice in criminal prosecutions. Accordingly, Fitzgerald emphasized that there is a lesser public interest in actions for civil damages than in criminal prosecutions. And although the court declined to approve the exercise of jurisdiction over the president in a case involving a merely private suit for damages, it acknowledged that the exercise of jurisdiction over the president has been held warranted in order to vindicate the public interest in an ongoing criminal prosecution. This case also involves a countervailing Article II consideration absent in Fitzgerald. Petitioner's immunity claim would frustrate the executive branch's enforcement of the criminal law. In Fitzgerald, all the relevant executive branch interests counseled in favor of recognizing immunity from private civil suits, there based on implied rights of action. A federal prosecution, in contrast, implicates the president's constitutional responsibility to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. The Attorney General and federal prosecutors help fulfill that constitutional function. Allowing a former president to assert absolute immunity from applicable criminal laws would frustrate the executive's constitutional authority and responsibility to enforce those laws. It would be a striking paradox if the president, who alone is vested with the constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, were the sole officer capable of defying those laws with impunity. 2. Robust safeguards protect against the risk of improper prosecutions. The interests on the other side of the scales also weigh against criminal immunity because the possibility of federal criminal prosecution after a president leaves office imposes a much lesser burden on the executive branch than the private civil suits at issue in Fitzgerald. Fitzgerald reasoned that highly intrusive private lawsuits from countless people directed at a former president, an easily identifiable target, would chill the president's conduct and render him unduly cautious in the discharge of his official duties. Those concerns do not translate to the federal criminal context. All federal prosecutions must originate in the executive branch itself, acting through DOJ. Institutional standards of impartial prosecution are embedded in long-standing DOJ norms set forth in department policy. The grand jury provides a further independent check against abusive prosecutions, and a trial unfolds in public within the systemic constraints of the adversary criminal justice system. Finally, Article III courts, including this court, ensure that any prosecution of a former president stays within constitutional limits. A. The executive branch and the criminal justice system contain strong safeguards against groundless prosecutions. Congress has vested in the Attorney General the power to conduct the criminal litigation of the United States government, and DOJ has a long-standing commitment to the impartial enforcement of the law. DOJ's standards and institutional structures reinforce those values. Federal prosecutors are required to make prosecution decisions based on the facts and the law. This court has explained that, based on long experience, absent clear evidence to the contrary, courts presume that federal prosecutors have properly discharged their official duties. The criminal justice system provides further safeguards. Federal felony indictments must be returned by the grand jury, which is a constitutional fixture in its own right, and serves as a kind of buffer or referee between the government and the people. Grand juries are prohibited from engaging in arbitrary fishing expeditions and initiating investigations out of malice or an intent to harass. Prosecutions are also subject to public scrutiny and rigorous protections for a defendant's rights. The accused is guaranteed a fair trial with an array of procedural rights, and the government bears the burden to prove its allegations beyond a reasonable doubt to a unanimous jury, which guards against abusive, unfounded prosecutions. These established safeguards sharply contrast with the potential barrage of unscreened private damages actions that concerned the Fitzgerald Court. B. Article III courts, including this court, provide the ultimate check against potentially abusive prosecutions of former presidents. Politically motivated prosecutions violate the Constitution, and courts will review a former president's claims meticulously. The groundless threats of politically motivated prosecution that petitioner fears would not survive such review. Courts will also enforce the due process principle that a criminal statute must provide a person of ordinary intelligence fair notice of what is prohibited. If a former president lacked fair warning that his official acts would violate a criminal prohibition, a court would dismiss a prosecution on due process grounds. Here, the district court correctly rejected petitioner's due process challenge to the charge statutes, but those requirements would protect a former president if a case arose in which he lacked fair notice. Together, these layers of familiar safeguards refute petitioner's contention that without his novel absolute immunity claim, the president cannot function, and the presidency itself cannot retain its vital independence. Because a greater interest exists in vindicating the public's interest in enforcement of the criminal laws by executive officials vested by law with that singular public responsibility than in permitting private individuals to pursue tort suits. And because greater protections exist for a former president in the criminal context. Fitzgerald's reasoning does not support petitioner's claim of absolute immunity from criminal prosecution. Congress remains free, however, to respond with appropriate legislation if it deems it appropriate to afford the president stronger protection from liability. D. Federal criminal law applies to the president. Petitioner's opening brief in this court asserts, for the first time in this litigation, that the doctrine of immunity requires courts to interpret criminal laws to exempt the president unless he is expressly named. That claim finds no basis in text, congressional intent, this court's precedents, or Office of Legal Counsel, OLC, opinions. And existing principles of statutory construction, as well as the availability of as-applied constitutional challenges, ensure that federal criminal statutes do not impede the president's ability to carry out his constitutionally assigned duties. 1. The express text of nearly all federal criminal laws covers all persons, including the president. The statutes under which petitioner has been indicted are illustrative. They use the terms whoever and person to describe their coverage. Both terms naturally include individuals who occupy government offices such as the presidency. And another provision of the criminal law, 18 U.S.C. 202C, demonstrates that Congress knows how to exclude the president from a broadly defined term when it wishes to do so. That statute provides that the terms officer and employee in five specific statutes shall not include the president, the vice president, a member of Congress, or a federal judge. No evidence exists that Congress intended courts to graft an extra-textual exception for the president into all the other federal criminal laws in which he is not specifically named. Only two criminal statutes would appear to remain applicable to the president under that rule. One prohibits a covered government person from taking an official act to influence private employment decisions, and then defines a covered government person to include members of Congress and the president, vice president, and executive branch employees. The other includes the president as one of the officials who is barred from soliciting or receiving campaign funds in any room or building occupied in the discharge of official duties. It is implausible that Congress intended for the president to face criminal sanctions for influencing private employment or accepting campaign contributions in federal buildings while exempting him from every other federal criminal statute, including those barring bribery, murder, treason, and seditious conspiracy, none of which mentions the president. And accepting petitioner's understanding of federal criminal law would render hollow his concession that the president may face criminal prosecution after impeachment and conviction. Under petitioner's rule, scarcely any laws would allow such a prosecution to proceed. 2. Petitioner errs in asserting that his statutory construction argument finds support in this court's decisions or OLC's opinions. To the contrary, those sources recognize a more tailored principle of statutory construction that comes into play only when the application of a particular statute presents a serious risk of infringing the constitutional powers of the executive branch. A. This court has twice construed terms in a statute to avoid such a risk. In Public Citizen v. United States Department of Justice, 1989, the court interpreted the term utilized in the Federal Advisory Committee Act to exclude a particular application of the statute that would have created formidable constitutional difficulties by intruding upon the president's prerogative under Article 2 to nominate and appoint officers of the United States. And in Franklin v. Massachusetts, 1992, the court construed the term agency in the Administrative Procedure Act, APA, to exclude the president to avoid the serious separation of powers questions that would have arisen if the APA's judicial review provisions were understood to permit Article III courts to review the president's performance of his statutory duties for abuse of discretion. Neither decision supports reading an implied exception for the president into every criminal statute that does not name him. Rather, in both cases, the court responded to a specific and serious separation of powers concern raised by the statute. In Public Citizen, the threat of intrusion on the president's appointment clause power, and in Franklin, the risk that the judicial branch would be allowed to second-guess the president's policy decisions. And in both cases, the court adopted a targeted solution that avoided the problem while hewing as closely as possible to the statutory text. Thus, in Public Citizen, the court interpreted the term utilize to exclude a specific application to a presidential advisory committee involved in judicial nominations while recognizing that the statute continued to apply to other presidential advisory committees. And in Franklin, the court's interpretation of the term agency to exclude the president was in keeping with the ordinary meaning of the term agency, which connotes a government entity, not an individual. B. OLC has distilled from these decisions a clear statement principle that interprets general statutes that do not expressly refer to the president not to reach him where doing so would raise a serious question under the separation of powers. But that principle cannot justify the blanket presidential exception from the criminal law that petitioner seeks because, as OLC has explained, many applications of the criminal law to the president do not implicate separation of powers concerns, much less serious ones. Thus, OLC has observed that the clear statement principle does not apply to 18 U.S.C. Section 201, the primary federal bribery law, explaining that applying Section 201 to the president raises no separation of powers question, let alone a serious one, because the Constitution confers no power in the president to receive bribes. The same reasoning applies to the statutes charged here. Further, where OLC has found that particular applications of a criminal law to the president raise serious separation of powers concerns, it has construed the statute to exempt those particular applications rather than exempting the president from the law altogether. For example, OLC has concluded that serious constitutional problems support a broad interpretation of an exception to the criminal anti-lobbying statute to cover most forms of routine communication by the president and his direct subordinates. But OLC has cautioned those officials against engaging in the grassroots lobbying that is at the heart of the statutory prohibition. Similarly, when OLC determined that it would create serious separation of powers concerns to apply the criminal contempt of Congress statute to an official asserting executive privilege on the president's behalf, OLC did not conclude that the president or any other executive branch official is entirely excluded from the statute, instead finding that the statute does not apply to presidential assertions of executive privilege. And to the extent OLC would construe a criminal statute to exempt the president altogether, such a decision would be based on a conclusion that most or all of the statute's core applications to the president would present serious separation of powers concerns. But no such claim can be made here. 3. Petitioner suggests that his novel implied presidential exception from all federal criminal law is necessary to protect the president's ability to carry out his constitutionally assigned functions. But that purpose is already achieved by existing principles of statutory construction and, as applied, constitutional challenges. If a former president were prosecuted under a criminal law that raises serious separation of powers concerns in a particular context, an Article III court could first determine whether a background principle such as the public authority defense protects against liability. Construe the statute to avoid a serious separation of powers concern, or, if that is not possible, declare a particular application of the statute unconstitutional. 4. Petitioner, however, has no plausible as-applied separation of powers challenge to the criminal laws he is alleged to have violated. Indeed, petitioner did not even challenge the constitutionality of the statutes on this basis, despite making numerous other pretrial claims. And such a challenge could not succeed. The Constitution does not give a president the power to conspire to defraud the United States in the certification of presidential election results, obstruct proceedings for doing so, or deprive voters of the effect of their votes. And because neither Article II nor any other constitutional provision gives the president any role in certifying the election of his successor, petitioner cannot make a viable claim that the president's constitutional role renders it essential for him to engage in the criminal conduct alleged in the indictment. Thus, even if petitioner had properly preserved a separation of powers challenge to the application or interpretation of the statutes in the indictment, it would fail. We've come to the end of the second segment of this brief. But don't worry, next episode we will pick up right where this episode left off. Until then, thanks for listening to What SCOTUS Wrote Us.